All right, so the book of John is super fun. We are getting close to the end, though. Tonight we're going to read John chapter 18 and a good chunk of it here. This section typically in most of our Bibles is called Peter's Denial, but it's also just it's a good reminder this is about Jesus being on trial also. And you've seen your notes in there that I put that it's not just Jesus that's on trial, but in a very real way, it's Peter that's on trial as well in here. To give you a little bit of context for this, I'm going to go back to John chapter 13 and read just a couple verses of that. And one of the things that's cool about this story is, you know, there's four stories about the life of Jesus in our Bibles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it's pretty rare that all four books share the same story. And that's true of the story about Jesus' trial and Peter's denial. It's in all four of the books. They essentially tell the same story, but there are a few kind of neat details that each of them have uniquely. And so I'm going to put a small tag to the story that you'll see after we read the John passages from the book of Luke, kind of a conclusion that isn't in the rest of them, which is good to read. It's also in Matthew, I think, actually. Just one other quick reminder for like context, because we've been away from the book of John for a while here. The book of John really is part one and part two, and part one is the first 12 chapters, which is really all about primarily Jesus's 3 years of ministry, public ministry. And starting with chapter 13, which is that great story about Jesus having his last supper with his good friends, his last meal together with them. That starts in chapter 13. And so from there up until the next couple of chapters after chapter 18 is all about one, not even a day, but several hours, starting in chapter 13, all the way through this story and past, a few hours in Jesus' life, starting with this last meal. So you start in John chapter 13, he has that meal and that supper, and then they all go out together across the Kidron Valley. Jesus does all of that teaching and prayer. He goes up to the garden. He asks his friends to stay awake and pray. The soldiers come and arrest him in the garden and bring him back into town. So I just want to start real quick with John chapter 13 to lay the groundwork for this. So Peter, Jesus says to him, I'm going away, and you can't come with me where I'm going right now. And Peter asks in John chapter 13, he says, Lord, why can't I follow you now? And Peter, he's like, I'm with you, man. Whatever happens, I am with you. You can count on me. He says, I'll lay down my life for you. Jesus knows, though, and he answers him. He says, will you really lay down your life for me? He says, truly, man, get this. He says, truly, I tell you, before the rooster crows, before this day is over, this is nighttime, before this day is over, before the morning comes, you're going to disown me not once, not twice, but three times, right? Big contrast here. So John chapter 18, Jesus is on trial now. So this is what it says. He's been brought in back into town. It says, the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials, they arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas because he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good, get this, for one man to die for all the people. That's what he says, and I'll give you some context for this in a little bit here. So he goes on to say, Simon, Peter, and another disciple following Jesus. So this other disciple, John doesn't like to brag about himself, but this is John. So he's the other disciple that's with Peter. Because the disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the priest's courtyard. But Peter, he had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, this is John, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and she brings Peter into the courtyard. Now, she comes in and the servant says, you, aren't you one of this man's disciples too? Aren't you? She asked, and Peter, his first chance to stand up for Jesus, to be counted with the guy who has been so good to him, and he's seen so much with his first opportunity to do that, he goes, Nope, don't know him. It's kind of funny to actually think about. I mean, it's sad, but it's kind of bizarre. Verse 18, so it's cold, and the servant and the official stood around the fire that they had made to keep warm. Peter was also standing with them. So you see here, there's two stories here, and two people are being asked direct questions. And we're going to read Jesus's questions that he's asked. So meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teachings. And he says, Jesus says, I've spoken openly to the world. Jesus said, I always taught in the synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. And he said, I didn't say anything in secret. Why question me? Ask those who have heard. In other words, he says, it's public record. He said, surely they know what I said. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. Jesus says, is this the way? The guy says to him, is this the way you answer the high priest? He demanded. Jesus says, if I said something wrong, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? So then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest, right? So there's two people being asked very direct questions here. And John is doing this on purpose. Peter is being asked direct, simple questions. Do you know this guy? Peter lies. Jesus gets asked very direct, critical questions, knowing that the answers are not going to satisfy people. And he tells the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So you see, there's two people being put on trial here. And one person's telling the truth, and the other person is lying. So 25. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there. He's warming himself. So they asked him, hey, you, aren't you one of his disciples too? Are you? He denied it, saying, I'm not. And in the Greek, this is really emphatic. I'm not, he says. One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter a few hours earlier had cut off, challenged him, didn't I see you with him in the garden? And again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, the rooster began to crow. Three times here, Luke adds kind of a little conclusion to the story that's really good. At that moment, the Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. And Peter remembered the words that Jesus had spoken to him earlier in the night, right? Before the rooster crows today, you'll disown me three times. And Peter's reaction is the weight of his inability to be loyal to Jesus and Jesus' moment of needing someone to stand up with him, that would have been great. He goes outside and he wept bitterly. So in your notes, there's three things I want to walk through here with you about this story. The first one is, I think, I typically think for most of my Christian life, especially early Christian life, was pretty hard on people like Peter in the Bible that I feel like didn't get it. You know, I mean, you think of all the things that Peter got to see and do. I mean, whoa. I mean, talk about having a front row seat to Jesus and all of his power. And what an opportunity for Peter to stand up for Jesus. And I'm like, man, what's wrong with you, buddy? But when I read stories like this today, I think just because I see my own fallibility in life, like I can see how I let other people down and I know I let God down, I think I've become a little more gracious reading these stories about Peter here. But there is something really important for us as we read this that I want you to think about, which is how do you react when your hopes, dreams, desires, and plans don't get fulfilled in life? See, Peter really, he was super ambitious about Jesus. Like, he's like, I mean, he understood that Jesus was a person unlike anybody else who'd ever lived. And he saw that Jesus was a guy who could do anything and could set the world right in a capacity nobody else had ever had the capacity to do. And Peter's stoked because he's on that train, and he feels like Jesus is heading in this direction to set everything straight. And now, all of a sudden, in a few hours, all of that is compromised. The guy who can do everything and has all the power in the world, all of a sudden, other people have power over Jesus. And all of this ambition and plans that Peter has for Jesus and you know, for himself as well, because he's like riding the coattails of Jesus, it's all gone upside down. And he's scared not only for Jesus, but certainly scared for himself, because he sees this isn't going well for Jesus right now. And man, oh man, does this flip him upside down? And I think that there's something at the root of this that's important for us to think about. Because my suspicion is that Peter thinks he knows better than Jesus does about how to handle this situation. See, Peter recognizes these guys are corrupt religious leaders. And he's like, he knows Jesus has got the ability to do something about this. And right? I think Peter thinks, I know better than he does. I know better what should happen here than what God is allowing to happen. And it really flips him upside down. And there's something in here that I think is easy to miss, which is about humility and what happens in our pride in life. That we sometimes, I think, fall into the same trap of we think we know better what God should be doing. And when he doesn't do it, I think sometimes we react foolishly as well. There's this great book that we provided to everyone who took our 201 class a couple weeks ago. It's by this guy, Gary Thomas. And the subtitle of the book is, what does God do to help us become the people he made for us to be? And the first two chapters in the book, he says, this is the foundation for you to become the person. You can't become the person God wants you to be without humility, without putting God in his place and you in your place under his authority. And he says this in his book. He says, from a spiritual perspective, humility, it's entering into the life of Christ through a radical dependence on God. See, and I think this is one of the things that we have sort of lied about as Christians, is we've told people, as long as you pray a prayer and you ask Jesus into your life, it'll all be good. That's all you need to do. Just pray a prayer and you'll be forgiven and it's great. That's a little bit different than thinking about God's desire is for us to enter into a relationship with him that affects every day, every moment of our life. Right? That's a big difference between those two things. He says it's an inner orientation of actively receiving from God and acknowledging our needs. See, I think this is part of the problem is most of us, I look around this room and I know a lot of you in here, and you are enormously capable people. And I think what ends up happening is we can sort of just on our own wisdom and power and you know, abilities, we can navigate most of life on our own. And so what ends up happening is we really only reach out to God when we're in trouble. You know, and it's not supposed to be like that. We're supposed to recognize God, thanks for the gifts and talents you've given me, but I need you every single day. And I want to be dependent, not on my own strengths and abilities, but on you. And there's a big difference between those two things. See, I'm not sure that you can really get from God all that he has to offer us unless you are that humble person. He goes on to say, the humble Christian is a Christian who takes literally Christ's words. And this comes out of John chapter 15 that we read a couple of months ago. Jesus says, I'm the vine, you're the branches. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Do you really believe that? You can't accomplish any of the things that God really made for you to be and do apart from dependence on him? So Andrew Murray nails it exactly when he calls it the displacement of yourself and the enthrone, in other words, the throne in your life. The person who's running your life is God, not yourself. And I think that this reveals to us a good opportunity to see that Peter ultimately thinks the train should be going this way. He knows where Jesus should be going. And Jesus should be following along his train. And Jesus says, no, no, no. And the funny thing about this is has Jesus made it clear that he's going away? Peter just doesn't want to hear what Jesus has very clearly, both overtly and subvertly, told everybody about his plan. And Peter just doesn't want to hear it because ultimately he knows better how God should be doing things. See, we need a daily reminder, I think, of putting God in his proper place. This is a text thread from me and my wife. You see her name at the top there, and I blurred out, obviously, most of the message here. But I just want you to key on this. On Wednesday this week, I write to her. Mine is the blue bubble there. I said, I love you. What's it say there? Today. She responds back. Thursday, I text her again, and it says, I love you today. See, why do that? I mean, I already said it once. Isn't that good enough? I do a lot of weddings, and I had a wedding here like a week and a half ago. And the couple comes up, and they walk forward full of enthusiasm for the moment. They say these great things to each other. In sickness and in health, for richer or poorer. Till death do us part. I mean, great things. Anybody in here been married and know that it takes a little more than just that one thing of commitment for a marriage to really work? See, it takes something that is like a daily thing. And one of the things, how would our marriages be different if first thing in the morning we recognized how important that reminder was, and we did it every day. Rather than reach for your iPhone, you reach your devotions, and you roll over to your spouse, and you repeated that stuff. This is what I'm here for today. And the dirty little secret is several years ago I started doing this. I call my wife, but typically I just text her, tell her I love you today, da 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 da. Why? And it's only partially for her, but honestly, it's primarily for me, because I want to be reminded every day. Dan talked about God's will for our lives, and I can tell every person that's married. People wonder, what's God's will for my life? What does he want me to do? I can tell you, if you're married, first thing, for every human being, married or not, pursue God and love him. Put him on the throne of your life every day. If you're married, I can tell you, number two, love your spouse. God put you in their life to help them become everything God made for your spouse to be. And if you have kids, number three, help your kids grow up in an environment where they can see that Jesus is real in everything. It's actually pretty simple to think about what God's will is for our lives. But I do think that with all the hustle and bustle and all the things that we think are really important, we put lots of other things on our priorities, and we forget daily the simple, most important things that God calls us to. And when we do that, and we forget who God is and who we are, sometimes our desires and our plans rise to the surface, and we expect God to follow along with us. And I'm convinced that's a part of what happens for Peter. And that's why in our 201 class, we tell people, learn to pray the prayer of surrender every morning, where you say, God, I belong to you. You brought me with a price, and I'm here today because you have a purpose for me. And all these things on my day timer, they're not unimportant, but Lord, you probably have things that aren't on my day timer that you want me to do today. And I want to hear your voice, and I want to be the man or woman that you made for me to be today, and how important that is. The second thing is, we miss this, but in this story, it's easy to forget that this is really about politics, is the underlying thing here. This isn't really about God. to the people involved in the story that are putting Jesus on trial. That's not what they're doing here. That's not their primary interest. It's about the Roman Empire. And the Romans have given them a little bit of autonomy. As long, and you can, they basically say, look, you can keep this autonomy as long as you keep the peace, the Roman peace, Pax Romana. That was their big thing. They just wanted people to just pay your taxes and don't make our armies come in and squash you. And the religious leaders are motivated because they want to hold on to their little slice of pie. And Jesus represents a threat to their little piece of pie, the way that they have organized it. And they recognize this. See, and that's why I told you, I'll go back to John chapter 11. Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead. And everybody knows about this now. And there is no hiding who Jesus is and what he could do anymore. Everybody gets this. Whoa. Right? And the religious leaders are like, oh, man, this is like, it's the final straw for them. And they're like, we got to do something about this guy, Jesus, because everybody's going to follow him. So these familiar names in here, notice this, the chief priests and the Pharisees, this is the religious and political leaders, basically, of the country, they call a meeting of the Sanhedrin, which is the ruling council of 70 people. And they ask this question, what are we accomplishing? They asked, here's this man, he's performed many miracles and signs. And if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And what's the consequences of that that they recognize? The Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Do you see that this is not about God and his desires for them and their country? This is about them holding on to their little piece of pie as they have organized it. Then one of them, and his name was Caiaphas, who we read about earlier, who was the high priest that year, spoke up and he said to the people, he says, you know nothing at all. Very insulting to the people, the other leaders. He says, don't you realize that it's better for this one guy to die for the people than for our whole nation to perish? Do you see what's going on here? And see, this really should raise a question when you read this and you think about what's going on in here. Jesus has said, I'm building a kingdom. Rome has a kingdom. And the religious leaders recognize that there is already a king and a kingdom. And they're not sure that they want Jesus to come and threaten that because it might not work out so well for them and their nation. So think about this. You and I probably would argue about a whole lot of things about God, and I get that. But one of the things I think everybody in here we would agree with is God could do, he's got the power to do whatever he wants, right? He could orchestrate history any way he wants to. God doesn't like corrupt people, so why doesn't he get rid? Why doesn't Jesus get rid of these guys? Why does he put up with them? Because he clearly could have gotten rid of them either right in that moment or shortly after. He could have done it, right? Why doesn't he do that? See, it's interesting to think about this also. Nobody would argue that Paul's life was greatly encumbered by the Roman machine. He even goes to jail. Do you notice that Paul never once, ever prays and says, Lord, you could do so much more if you just get rid of the Romans? And why doesn't Paul ever say to his friends and his followers, he's got a bunch of them, to say, would you pray with me that we could get Christian leaders and get rid of these Romans? Never once. Never once. There is this thing, I think, that very oftentimes we think that God's kingdom and his ability to work in the world is somehow tied to political outcomes. And if we could just get the right people in office, then everything would work out really well for us and for our country and for God's kingdom. But do you see that God is more than competent to bring about his will for his people and his church, despite who's in power or to work with who's ever in power. And he never says that's the key to his kingdom thriving in the world. Don't ever confuse this. Don't ever confuse this. Don't ever put your hope or thinking that God's kingdom is going to thrive with certain people in power. See, you may not like our governor in California. You may not like the president now, or you might not like the president 4 years ago. But they, whatever level of corruption you think our current political leaders have, it's nothing on these guys, nothing. And Jesus didn't say, you know what, things will work out better if we just get rid of them. Doesn't do it. Corbett points out from Rodney Stark, who's a sociologist, and when he wrote this book, people don't know this, he wasn't a Christian, but he was curious, how did Christianity become like this global thing? Because Jesus was just one guy in a small, out-of-the-way, podunk place. So how did Christianity become this thing? And he does this great work on sociology to help us think through how this happened. Because if you think about this, in about 40 AD, give or take, there's about 1,000 people that call themselves Christians, followers of Christ. In the Roman Empire, the population of Rome, that would have meant 0.0017% of the population was Christian. Now, nobody's going to argue that Rome was hostile. They didn't like, they didn't understand Christians. They were not in favor of them at all. And socially, people didn't like the Christians. Even like the older brothers who were the Jewish people, and Christianity rises up in that family, the Jews weren't particularly favorable to the Christians when push came to shove. So how in the world did this happen that by 350 AD, the majority of people in the Roman Empire, from 0.0017% of the population, Christianity grows up in a hostile political and social environment, and God grows his church anyway. Don't make a mistake of thinking it's because of Constantine, because Constantine does not come on the scene until about, he doesn't legalize Christianity until after 300, and it's already well on its way. And he doesn't make Christianity, this is a mistake people think, that he made Christianity the official religion of the empire, and he didn't. All he did was just, and it's a political thing. He sees that there are so many Christians that he wants to be nice to the Christians to earn favor with them. He just makes it legal. But Christianity was well on its way, exploding despite hostility both politically and socially. See, it's good to remember that God's ability is his spirit. God desires to work in and through people that love him and are committed to him, despite whatever the social or political environment is. And that's how God will grow his church, through committed people that put him first in their lives every day. It's interesting also, just the closing thing, is just like this idea of like three, you know, we have this idea of like three strikes and you're out in baseball and other things too. It's interesting because I think most of us would understand or appreciate if Jesus had decided, Peter denies me three times, and this is like his last shot. I'm sort of done with Peter. I need to find some other more loyal, committed people. Because this three strikes thing with Peter right here, the three denials, is actually kind of consistent with Peter. There's a lot of times as you read through the scriptures about Jesus' life that sometimes Peter seems to work against what Jesus is trying to accomplish. So this isn't like a flash in the pan, but this sort of is almost consistent with the way Peter has done things. And it's really fascinating because I think that for me and most people I know, that betrayal, not three times, but just once, cuts, especially by people that we assume would be most loyal to us, it cuts to our heart. There's very little that is wounding or is painful in our lives as the people that we count on, that we're loyal to, that we think should be loyal to us, than when we feel let down by them. I think that's one of the hardest things to do, and to learn to be forgiving towards people like that. But it's interesting, and this is part of what we love about Jesus, is Jesus spent so much time talking about God's goodness and his grace and his patience, and it's exhibited by people that are forgiving people. I have in your notes in there, ironically, it's Peter that asked this question about forgiveness. So in Matthew chapter 21, it says, Peter comes to Jesus and he says, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? And he says, he's going to be generous. He says, up to seven times? He's stretching himself out here. And Jesus answers him, I tell you, not seven, but three times. And then you can be done with people that just don't get it. Are you still awake? Are you with me? It's not what he says, is it? Jesus answers, I tell you, not seven times, but seven times seven. And this isn't a math equation. It's the perfect number, seven and seven. He's saying, this is how you live. And even after this, I mean, you think about this. Peter is so broken by his inconsistency that when Jesus dies and is buried, he goes back to fish. He goes back to his old life. He takes his friends and he goes, this game is over. Let's go back to fishing. And that's what he does. Goes back to his old life, his old profession. You know the first person that Jesus, the first group of people that Jesus goes out to in John chapter 21 after he meets with some of the people in the upper room and some people seek him out? Jesus goes and he finds Peter and he says, we're not done here. I'm not done with you. Come back. Leave that boat. Please, I don't ever want to hear out of people. And don't you let other people say this either. I've done too many bad things. I've gone too far away that God just can't do anything with me or wouldn't want to have anything to do with me. I've been too disloyal. God is not done with us. And the more you come in contact with the reality of how good and gracious and patient God is with you, I really believe that this is what will help you become a more gracious and forgiving person. Lord, thanks for the opportunity we have to get back into the book of John. So many good things in here. So thankful to be able to explore from chapter 11 and chapter 13 all the way up into the book of Luke today. Just being reminded of how good you are. And I love like what Bethany was saying just about your spirit and the power of your spirit alive and at work in the world, but also in our lives and the lives of the people that we know and love. And so, Lord, as you are gracious with us, Lord, help us be gracious with other people too. Thanks for loving us, Lord, and the time to be able to explore these things together. We always thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you guys. Thanks for coming. Don't forget about, we'll continue our service with our offering, and that's a form of worship. And be able to support other people that are working around the world for God's good purposes. Thanks for coming, everybody.